Last Monday night, Guy Donzi spoke at the Van City 60th Anniversary event at the Italian Cultural Center. He's the author of Stormy Weather, 101 Solutions to Climate Change. I reached him at his home in Victoria.
Good afternoon, Guy. It's Alex at Radio EcoShock. How are you doing?
Hi, Alex. I'm fine, thanks. Yes.
Well, you were a keynote speaker at Van City's 60th Anniversary celebrations on September the 25th. What was your theme for the folks there?
Well, the theme of the evening was looking at global climate change in the very big picture and asking, what does it take to eliminate 100% of our greenhouse gas emissions? So, you know, no one's discussing, is the science right or is the science wrong? There's a total strong consensus that global warming is for real, that it's caused by humans, that the future impacts are going to be unbelievably dramatic. I mean, potential 4-meter sea level rise within this century. Masses of earth extinctions, forest fires, you name it. And so the mind then shifts to how do we deal with this? What are the solutions involved?
Well, so you're actually going further. I mean, I've heard, for example, I just heard a UK broadcaster talking about the UK needed to go 90% down, but you're actually envisioning a new society that doesn't run on fossil fuels.
Entirely, absolutely. It's the only natural and the logical way to think. In fact, thinking that way really clarifies the brain. It's like if you're an alcoholic and you want to give up alcohol, you set your goal as drinking no alcohol, not as like, you know, maybe I can just get by on 2 drinks a week. And if you look at the world's supply of fossil fuels, if you imagine that you are a historian 1,000 years in the future and you look back on the present time, you'll see that the age of fossil fuels lasted from 1850 to 2050. Then all of the oil and gas was gone. There's still coal left. And, you know, we all see that we also decided not to use the coal because by the time we've solved the problem of oil and gas, we'll know that there are so many easy alternatives to run the world. And global civilization, you know, will happily carry on for another 1,000, 10,000, a million years. I see no reason for it not to, because I believe that humans have the ability, both through political action and through being smart, ingenious, cooperative, loving, to handle the crisis we're facing. So we'll see that the age of fossil fuels was a very, very short episode in human history when we got a sudden boost of energy from the ancient past, millions of years ago. Photosynthesis that laid down, you know, energy in what's called ancient sunshine. And we had a chance to use it to build a very modern, post-industrial, sustainable, green, clean, peaceful world. And we still have that potential. But people are now finally waking up to the urgency of the need to do so.
You know, it's a very sci-fi or medieval tale in a way. We make a deal with an ancient, it's not really an ancient devil, but we find this ancient substance, a sort of coagulated, collected sunlight, if you will. But when we bring it out and use it, it recreates the time that it came from. It came from a very hot period, we believe.
No, it's not. That's not quite it, because the fossil fuels are laid down over so many, you know, 200 or 300 million years, and during that time, Earth went through all sorts of changes. The key point, where you're semi-correct, is that it's all sunlight that was laid down over 200 or 300 million years, and we're burning it in 200 years. So we're burning it a million times faster than it was laid down. And so
it's like an energy magnifying glass in a way.
Enormously, though. Enormously so, to take such incredibly dense energy and burn it all at once. We should be right now thinking, how do we make the world supply of oil last for a million years? Because there may never be an energy quite so dense and, you know, compact as oil and gas, because they are, you know, the heritage of so many million years. And, you know, we're going to always need to fly to, you know, earthquake scenes and emergencies and stuff like that. And I have not found any substitute fuel for flying. You can't fly with electric power. If you fly with hydrogen, the volume needed is just enormous.
Well, you know,
biofuels for flying, that the land needed to grow the biofuels, and this applies to all forms of transportation using biofuels. The capsule on this one is that the land needed to fill, if you grow ethanol and use the ethanol to make fuel, put it in a car, the land needed for one SUV fill-up could feed a person for a whole year. So that's the kind of trade-offs we're making if we look for land-based fuel.
Yes, you know, I had a 1955 report from the Atomic Energy Commission, and they were planning on developing nuclear airplanes, and I just pictured, oh, that's great. You know, you've got reactors flying around,
yes.
And when planes crash down, they come. Well, listen, I Googled you, as I think my listeners should do as well, and for them it's Dauncey. I see you won the Green Book of the Year Award back in 1988.
And you've done your homework here, yes.
And you've released a couple of books since then with New Society Publishers. They're one of the most socially responsible book publishers anywhere.
Yes.
And the big one for me is your latest, Stormy Weather, 101 Solutions to Global Climate Change.
Yes.
Are you planning an update to that one, or is there a new book
exactly
in the works?
The publishers want me to do that. It's down to the last few copies now. It's virtually sold out. And so the publishers want me to update it entirely. And that's an enormous task, because since I wrote it in the year 2000... in 2001, an awful lot has changed in the technology, in the speed of policy, in the political commitment, in the examples of people doing great stuff. And some things have changed in my understanding. When I started the book, I didn't really twig just how potent the electric vehicle was. I had a piece on hydrogen saying, well, maybe this is a possible way to go, and a piece on future hydrogen vehicles. But the future is really electric vehicles. It's not hydrogen vehicles, and it's not biofueled ethanol vehicles either. There'll always be some vehicles going around on biodiesel and biofuels. But electric vehicles are the absolute way to go. The fuel conversion ratio, or rather the energy conversion ratio using sunlight to grow plants versus putting sunlight through a photovoltaic cell is 40 times greater when you use electric vehicles. And because the electric vehicle drive is so incredibly efficient, your average running cost is going to be under $10 a month. For a small, smart, lightweight electric vehicle. Right now, if you have an electric moped, it's costing you 10 cents a day, a tenth of a cent per mile to run it, because electricity is such an efficient way to go for power. So that shifts the whole way of thinking. Like, if all our transport is basically premised on electricity, and for long distance, you can use the plug-in hybrid. That's a hybrid vehicle, like the Toyota Prius or the Honda Civic, that has a gas engine and an electric engine, and you put in extra batteries so that you can plug it in at night or at daytime while you're at work to recharge the batteries, and this makes that all your local trips are effectively in an electric vehicle, but it's also got the long distance when you need it.
So we don't really have to stay at home in the dark. There are solutions that could keep us moving around the way
totally,
we're used to.
Totally. Whichever way you look, there are solutions. I run for transport, which is one of the big things to think about. I run through the whole gamut. Like, you know, how much more easy could we make it for walking? A lot of communities make it very difficult for walking. There's no sidewalks. You're walking along dusty concrete blocks. How much easier could we make it for cycling? So that all of our communities were really crisscrossed with safe off-road cycling paths, where you're not in danger of being hit by one of these big SUV mirrors that's like a foot wide. And when people are just getting used to cycling and their muscles aren't strong, they can have an electric bike to use on the hills. So there's no reason why we shouldn't be having 15, 20% of our trips done by bicycle, and people really enjoying the experience of bicycling. And then transit is such a natural. Transit should be taking about 20% of our trips. And the way to do that is to do for the whole community what UBC has done for the university with the UPass system. Entire neighborhoods should be able to sign on to a UPass system where instead of paying by the bus trip, they pay for the bus on their municipal taxes in advance at a discount rate, and everyone in the whole community can ride for free. Then you up the services, you up the efficiency, you make the buses, you know, really comfortable, because they're really packed and crowded in Vancouver right now. It's a real rush hour experience because there's not enough buses for the people who want to travel.
It's true, you know, and when I was in Amsterdam, they realized, for example, that certain people feel that they're making money or they have a certain class or whatever. They don't want to be in those crowded buses. So what they did there was they had deluxe buses, if you will, or streetcars. They were electric there.
Yeah.
And everybody has a nice seat, like an airline seat. They have a little table where they can put their laptop out.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Actually there's someone on there that will come along and bring you a soft drink.
Yeah.
And instead of costing $1 or $2, this one cost $3. It wasn't that much more, but it offered that second level of comfort for those who feel they don't want to go with regular public transit.
Yeah, all of the long-distance coach services will basically move to that mode. And if you're a commuter, and you imagine you've got a choice between a one-hour car ride, stopping and starting, overtaking, being overtaken in, you know, rush hour traffic, or sitting on a comfortable modern coach for an hour where you can read a paper, do your emails, talk to your neighbours, have an orange juice or a coffee. Hey, I mean, there's now discussion that people who use buses where you can work on the bus can actually count that as part of their working day. Because you can get work done. I get work done when I'm on the bus or the train or flying. I never get work done when I'm driving. Period. Ever.
Well, that's true. So actually people would get a bit of a paycheck for the time they're on the bus, so long as they're productive.
Absolutely, yes.
Well, yes. That's the kind of thinking we need.
Puts a new perspective on it.
You know, I talk to people and I get sort of, well, isn't climate change terrible? Followed right shortly by, well, I'm flying to Mexico for a few weeks. It's a total disconnect.
We're all in disconnect. I fly to conferences on global climate change. So there's one simple way to make the connection. It doesn't solve the problem, but I make my whole life carbon neutral. That means that I calculate my carbon emissions every year, and they're between 14 and 24 tons a year, of which between 10 and 14 tons are from flying. So my baseline emissions are like probably, you know, 3 to 4 tons from driving. We share one vehicle, my wife and myself, driving and occasional use of public transit, and from a little bit of electricity use, because most electricity in BC is not using fossil fuels. But I offset my emissions by writing a check every year to the Solar Electric Light Fund, which puts solar electricity into villages in the developing world, in Bhutan and Nigeria and South Africa, where the villagers no longer need to use kerosene fuel in the evenings for lighting. So to the extent that I help them put solar electricity on their roofs, it stops them using kerosene, and the mathematics of it balances out so that I'm reducing as much fossil fuel use as I produce. And anyone else wants to follow this, it's the Solar Electric Light Fund, which is SELF.org on the website. And there's a button on the right-hand side of their page called the Carbon Neutral Club, which Bill Clinton actually is a member of. Bill Clinton's global leadership summit, which he has every year, has neutralized its entire emissions last year by 50% by using the Solar Electric Light Fund, and 50% using another renewable energy initiative in North America.
Well, Clinton's been really amazingly active on the issue. I just heard that Rupert Murdoch and Barbara Streisand have gotten together, of all people, to donate hundreds of millions. And now we have Richard Branson signing on the line for $3 billion of carbon offsets, if you will, for his airline. And
yes, well, actually, Branson's initiative is quite amazing because he's not donating personal wealth in the way that, say, Bill Gates is. He is donating 100% of the profits from his whole transportation business, his flying and his railways. So you say that these businesses, all of the profits will be put into serving the transition to a new energy future, because he's putting them fully into assisting the solutions. He's not saying, well, put it on. ExxonMobil are putting money into researching climate change and stuff like that as an excuse for sort of, you know, well, maybe in 15 years' time we'll find out what we have to do. Meanwhile, we burn as much oil as we can. But Branson is putting the money into alternative energy solutions, so he'll be finding ways to make solar energy, tidal energy, wind energy, electric vehicles and stuff like, you know, quicker and easier and faster for people to use and cheaper.
Now, well, that's a new corporate model.
Very much so, yeah. And there's other corporate leaders who are tracking the same path, so it's actually very positive. It's such, you know, we're facing, Alex, a huge global emergency here, absolutely of the scale of the beginning of the Second World War, and the need to mobilize all nations together to stop a massive damage hit to the planet Earth. And then we mobilized together to fight off Nazism and fascism under Hitler, when it's taken over all of Europe and was threatening to sort of link up with Japan and take over India and take over Russia. And, you know, Hitler's dream was of a thousand-year Reich of absolute evil. And what we're coming up towards is, you know, not just 1,000 years, but maybe 10,000 years of climate chaos, if we don't get this thing under control really quickly. So it's great to see business leaders and government leaders such as Schwarzenegger, who's committed California to an 80% reduction in emissions by 2050 and a 25% reduction by 2020. I believe we should set a goal on 100% reduction by 2025. It really is, you know, focuses the brain. When we had the Second World War, we didn't set a goal of let's see if we can defeat Hitler by 2080. We said we do it immediately now, whatever it takes. Because we saw the emergency, we saw the crisis. So that's the position we need to be taking on it. And when you know that all of the solutions lead to a happier, healthier, you know, environmentally prosperous world, just as the solution to Hitler led to a return to freedom and democracy, why would we not want to do that immediately? The only reason not is laziness in our minds, habitual habits of lying on the sofa too much and watching TV and not thinking, and downright corporate corruption by the top leaders in the oil and coal industries and the auto industries who are actively trying to sabotage the whole thing.
Well, I want to get your reaction to the Harper government, our new government of Canada, as they call themselves. They seem to have trashed all our commitments to reduce Canada's greenhouse gases.
Yeah.
Have you heard anything about their Made in Canada plan? What's your thoughts there?
I'm in the dark as much as anyone else is. They fundamentally do not believe that climate change is caused by humans. I think that's the bottom line. And interestingly, I believe that Richard Neufeld, who is the BC Minister of Energy, holds the same belief. In other words, he's in bed with the skeptics, and he sort of dismisses climate change as irrelevant and not he's not doing any scientific homework, in other words, at all. And the Harper government is got exactly the same way of thinking. So the new Made in Canada plan that they're talking about is actually going to be a resurrection of the old Mulroney Green Plan called Green Plan 2. And when it comes out, it's going to have a lot of attention paid to air pollution, that's, you know, dirty smog and stuff in our cities, and to some toxic chemicals and a few other things like that, and almost nothing you'll find on climate change. I think they'll say that, well, we need to decide on a goal within 10 years' time or within 15 years' time, or something very lazy like that. My prediction is there'll be no goals, there'll be no mandatory programs, there'll be voluntary commitments, and there'll be a commitment to do more scientific research. Totally in line with the Bush agenda.
Wow.
But we'll wait and see. We'll wait and see. The good news was, here in Victoria, where the Conservative Party constituency associations for Victoria and Juan de Fuca and Saanich all got together and had a public speaking event with a man called Tim Ball, who calls himself a climatologist, who's a total skeptic. He's actually receiving expenses from the oil industry. And Gary Lunn, who is the Minister of Energy in the Harper government, came out and distanced himself quite strongly. So that's a good sign.
That's a bit of a good sign. Well, what do you think about the provincial Liberals are building more and more highways for cars and trucks, and it's the same kind of carbon-polluting economy that got us here.
The provincial Liberal government is like a freight train that is heading towards the golden dream of the 1950s, with the Premier, Campbell, in the caboose, pointing in the opposite direction. He's saying we want to have the best air quality in the world, the best water quality management in the world. We want to reduce our greenhouse emissions more than Oregon. But all the policies the government actually does, like putting up contracts to burn coal in British Columbia, expanding the freeway system, these are out of the good golden age of fossil fuels. And my analysis of the problem is that I think Campbell gets it. I think Campbell understands the problems, he's got a very limited gene pool he can draw on in terms of his MLAs and his cabinet. And, you know, there's no tradition of bringing other people into cabinet when you've got elected members who are chosen by the people, in quotes.
Right.
And he hasn't got enough quality in his MLA caucus to actually move ahead with the smart policy. So he's stuck with people like Kevin Falcon in transport, who actually said somewhere that, you know, he admired Mao Tse-tung, because if Mao Tse-tung wants to build a road, he just builds a road and you don't bother consulting people. And Richard Neufeld, who wants to build more coal-fired power plants.
Unbelievable
that we're doing this stuff, when the rest of the world is trying to unbuild its coal-fired power plants. And BC's trying to go out of its way to build them. It's just nutty.
They're living in a bell jar. Well, as individuals, we just can't depend on big governments. Obviously, they're dragging their feet. We all need to get involved now. And what are your suggestions for people to get informed and also to act on this?
On the individual level, I set up a new organization 2 years ago called the BC Sustainable Energy Association, specifically to enable individuals to get involved and work with us to change our personal habits, change our city policies, change our government policies. And we're very engaged. We were part of a coalition that successfully closed down the gas-fired power plant proposal here on Vancouver Island. We have a project running called 100,000 Solar Roofs to get solar PV and solar hot water systems on BC's roofs. We're engaged with the new government's energy plan, where they're discussing the whole future energy supply for British Columbia without consulting anyone in a public way. And we need people to get engaged. It's really good to do it personally. It's good to get out of your car, to cycle more, to buy a fuel-efficient vehicle when you have to drive, to offset your emissions, to eat less meat, because beef eating is a big part of climate change. But it's also really good to join with others. So in Vancouver, there's a very active chapter of the BC Sustainable Energy Association, which has monthly meetings and lots of stuff going on during the month as well. And any listeners who are interested can find out about it by going to our website, which is bcsea.org. And then you click on chapters and they go to Vancouver and see what they're up to there.
So that's bcsea.org.
Yes.
All right. Well, Guy Dauncey, thanks so much for talking with us today.
My pleasure then. Thanks very much.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
Join us every Friday at 1 o'clock on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver.